We are going to return this morning to a consideration of the Eighth Commandment. Eighth Commandment, which most overtly is forbidding us from taking each other's things. You shall not steal, is the Eighth Commandment. But I began our consideration of this subject by once again showing you what it is that's so important to God. Something beautiful that He's created and that He's trying to protect by this commandment, like with preceding commandments. So that was stewardship, God's ordination of certain resources, gifts that He gives to each one of us, and He intends for us to use them for His glory. He intends us to use our things for His glory, and He intends for our neighbor to use his or her things for His glory. And all violations of the Eighth Commandment are ultimately threats to that wonderful plan of God and our own place in that plan of exercising good stewardship. So I talked about some heart sins last week because I want us to not externalize these commandments. We want to recognize that they begin all within the heart. So, for example, contentment with what we have is a way of keeping the Eighth Commandment, and so on. I won't review all of that. Today we're going to move into something that is going to be extremely relevant in a daily way for many of you, and for all of you, for the rest of your lives. There's going to be a keeping or breaking of the Eighth Commandment issue for you in multiple ways as we do business, informally with each other, or more formally, as many of you will be in the workplace, and you'll actually be committing a majority of your waking hours to doing this thing we call business. Guys, business ethics, you've heard the term perhaps, is related primarily to the Eighth Commandment and the Ninth Commandment. We'll come to the Ninth Commandment soon enough, and you'll recognize even better when I get there why business involves so much both good stewardship and truth telling, which is the Ninth Commandment. You've known the expression, someone is a professional thief. That's just a reference to the fact that some people become very sophisticated in breaking the Eighth Commandment. And we tend to think of those as, I don't know, the Grand Theft Auto rackets and so on, or the mob, perhaps. But guys, we're going to be looking this morning under the first heading of the many ways that men and women pursuing an otherwise honorable vocation in the business world can be faced with the question, and will inevitably be faced with the question, will I be fair and honest and upright in dealings in business, or will I become the equivalent of a professional thief? So my first heading is, when doing business, quote unquote, becomes theft. And I'll lead off this whole area of consideration by a quote from Leviticus 25, verse 14. Listen to the law in that reference. If you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from him, all right, there's the business, right? Selling and buying, that's business. You shall not wrong one another. Wait a minute. You mean it's possible to wrong your neighbor when you sell to him? Yeah. You mean it's possible to wrong your neighbor in the way you buy from him? Yeah. All right, so that one little verse is encompassing what I'm going to be talking about next few minutes, and I have five different ways in which doing business can become a form of theft, and they are, I hope you'll see, exceedingly common and very natural for us in our flesh. Number one, exaggerating the true value of what you are selling. Proverbs 20, verse 23 gives a classic example of someone in sales who does this. Unequal weights are an abomination to the Lord. And false scales are not good. All right, what's he talking about? Does anybody know actually what the unequal weights reference is?
I think it'd be like in the money changing, when they have like a stack of coins on the other side, and maybe like gold or something.
Okay.
You're supposed to be changing like equal amounts.
All right. All right.
So that you're going to be getting more.
Very good. You and I don't think as much this way because things are all so prepackaged. But in an earlier day, when you would go in and, for example, want to buy something from a local mercantile, a bag of nails, for example, you'd buy it by the pound. Well, unless you brought your own scale with you, guess what? You're going to use the scale provided by the vendor, the seller. And in the old days, you know, the scales involved putting the nails on one side, if you'll go with me on that illustration, and these given set weights. So 1 pound here, right? And then you'd put the nails in the other until it equaled, right? And so you've got a pound. Unless the person using those weights had shaved a little off the weight. Unless the one selling is trying to, maybe just a little at a time, actually sell you a pound when he's actually giving you 15 ounces. Now that's just a very common way of saying, yes, here's the product, I'm selling you a pound of such and such, and it's exaggerated. It's not truly the amount. Guys, this is, in old school language, unequal weights. That's something that's the basic natural tendency of anybody who's got something to sell. It's the tendency of every seller in their flesh to exaggerate the value of what they're selling so they'll get more. So they get the most possible for it, even if that exceeds the true value of what they have. Guys, sometimes the exaggerating of the true value of what you're selling can come about by nothing more than concealing the defects of what's being sold. If you've ever experienced this directly or indirectly, you know what a lemon is? A car that's a lemon. It's a car that is just a problem waiting to happen. Somebody realizes that I've got a car, the main seal on the crankshaft is bad. This whole engine is going to need a rebuild. You know what I think I'm going to do? I think I'm going to sell it. And the seller in that situation is typically highly motivated, what? Not to share that about the car he's about to sell. Why would he do that? Then the buyer would realize the car isn't worth as much as it appears to be worth because it's about to need about a 5,000 repair job. And so he will conceal that element of the vehicle so that the person going into that business is paying full market value for something that the seller actually knows isn't worth full market value. Jessica? Ah, that's a great question. I didn't know, A, that North Carolina doesn't have a lemon law, and B, I don't know why. If they don't have that, I don't know why. There are actually states that recognize this is a form of fraud. And if you've ever been on the receiving end of it, you know quite well how you feel, don't you? Guess what? It feels different when you're the one with something to sell. I want to sell my house. I realize that it's full of termites, which is a pretty big deal if you're a homeowner. This is theoretical, by the way, I hope, I trust. I don't disclose that my house is going to need $45,000 worth of repairs. Now, there are so many patterns of this kind of behavior that, as Jessica's pointed out, there are actually laws that require disclosure of certain things. And so when you're selling a house, you actually do have legal requirement to disclose the true value of things, things that you know that the buyer doesn't or wouldn't necessarily know. The law does actually provide this, but there's all kinds of ways in the professional business world or in our private dealings, eBay, Craigslist, or putting your car out on the road with a for sale sign. There's all kinds of ways that we can violate the Eighth Commandment by exaggerating the true value of what you're selling, or closely related to that, concealing the defects of it. Let me think with you in this vein, under number one, about more subtle forms. If you go into sales, ladies and gentlemen, if you become a salesman, you will need to watch your own heart in just this area in order to honor God in that noble profession. Sales is a noble profession. At its best, sales is saying to a prospective customer, I have a product that I think would serve you well. Let me share with you about it. Sales in its worst form becomes an exercise of distortion and exaggeration in which you seek to persuade the customer of the value of what you have that is inflated beyond its real value for that person in order to get the sale. Do you see how Eighth Commandment is an everyday way of life? Keeping the Eighth Commandment is such. If you're involved in sales or, say, marketing, if you are involved in the marketing division of a corporation and you have a product that you know has serious defects, and yet you are marketing that product in such a way that you're conveying it has a value beyond what it really does, so that people will pay money for it. You can see how marketing can become an Eighth Commandment issue. It gets even more complicated than that. Some of you will be going into finance. You'll be going into that realm of business that involves evaluating the value of different businesses as measured by their stocks. Have you heard of insider trading? Insider trading is when someone on the inside of a company with inside knowledge is aware of something about to happen that will, for example, lower the stock value, and they sell in order to escape the consequences of what they on the inside know is going to depress the value of that stock. They have insider information, and they, knowing that the stock of that company isn't actually worth, in light of what they know, what the market presently will give for it, they sell just before the value, everyone else knows about it, and the value goes down. Now, you could go to jail for insider trading. That's against the law, but it's also something hard to nail down many, many times. These are very sophisticated examples of violations of the Eighth Commandment. If you have ever heard of market manipulation, now we're talking about things go well beyond my ability to fully fathom, but that's when large players in a certain market conspire together or take concerted action to bring about a gap between what they are selling and the value, the true value on the market. So oil cartels are sometimes known for this, in which various sellers of oil will artificially restrict the amount of output in order to inflate the price of the product so that they'll get a higher dollar amount per barrel, for example, than the market would otherwise sustain. There are not simple answers to some of those questions. I'm trying to just open a window for you of thought. The Eighth Commandment has a world of implications in our highly connected business world of today. And anytime someone is motivated in either very simple forms or highly complex forms to exaggerate the value of what they're selling over what it actually is, or to conceal the defects of what they're selling so the buyer isn't informed and pays more than it's actually worth. Guys, that's called stealing. That's what the Bible calls it. Number two, this is the mirror image of number one. If it's the universal tendency of sellers to exaggerate the value of what they're selling, number two, minimizing the true value of what we're trying to buy. That is a universal tendency in business. Here's a proverb for you. Proverbs 20, verse 14. Bad, bad, says the buyer. Or another translation. It's no good, says the buyer. But when he goes away, then he boasts. Are you following? Yeah, I don't think that's worth what you're asking for it. Oh, come on, man. That's a good fair... No, I don't think... See, look, it's got some rust on it. What's the tendency of the buyer? It's to talk down the value of what he wants to buy so that he can pay less than it's really worth. And as the proverb points out, after he spent all this time in the haggling, this was in a haggling kind of culture where in the marketplace you're actually bartering over the price. He says, oh, it's no good, it's no good, it's no good. He buys it and he says to his friends, you'll never believe what I just paid for this. It was the best deal of the century. Well, that's a tendency as well. And I'm going to push this home with a few hypothetical examples. I do this thought experiment with me. You're yard sailing. Somebody that has put a bunch of stuff out in the front yard and you stop by. Did any of you yard sale? I never yard sailed until I got married. And then I was introduced to the world of yard sailing. You know what? You can find some incredible buys yard sailing. People just want to get rid of stuff. They put it out there on the lawn. Suppose you've gone by and you see something that's been put out for sale and you happen to realize this person is selling something that's worth thousands of dollars and the price that they put on the sticker is $2. And you say to yourself, this is my lucky day. And you take that vintage whatever that I just heard something about a piece of china from an early era of Chinese history being found in such a way. You take that right up to the lady who's selling it and you say, I'll take this, please. And you pay $2. Whoa, you are amazing, aren't you? How do you feel about that? You might be thinking, well, I paid them what they asked. I paid them what they thought it was worth. I did exactly the right thing there. It just happened to be my lucky day that I knew how much it was worth. Okay. Well, I can imagine most of us having that kind of a thought. Let me switch this up on you and say, the person selling it is your grandmother. Granny just got $2 for what you're about to turn around and make thousands on. Does that change the scenario at all for you? You know it does, doesn't it? You know why? You know why? Because you love grandma. And you want what's good for her. And there's a certain range of, okay, people throw stuff out in the front yard. They don't care how much it's worth. They just want to get rid of it. Okay, there's a certain range where we could probably all agree it's okay. It's just fine. But when you encounter something like that and you all of a sudden put the person who's selling it in the place of your grandmother, something inside of you, doesn't it, says, I wouldn't do that to my grandmother. I think that little instinct is telling, because buying and selling, as I'll say in just a moment further, is to be an act of love for your neighbor. You guys ever been to Reed Goldmine? It's really cool. You should go there. It's one of our local attractions. And Reed Goldmine reminds us that our city, our surrounding area at least, was once one of United States' biggest gold repositories. And we had a gold rush in North Carolina. And then California came and nobody remembered us anymore. If you go to Reed Goldmine, you'll know the story about John Reed's son, Conrad. He's playing in the creek, like boys like to do, and he finds this really neat yellow-colored rock. And he brings it home with them, and they think it's all pretty cool, and they leave it there in the house as a doorstop for, if I remember, a few years. Eventually, somebody says, you know, you ought to have that looked at. And so they take it into Fayetteville, North Carolina, and a jeweler there, recognizing that this is a multi-pound, I think it was 6 pounds of gold, I can't remember what it was, says, it was 17 pounds. My notes are helping me out here. He sells a 17-pound hunk of gold for $3.50. Now, at the time, it was only worth $3,600. But how do you feel about that Fayetteville jeweler? Okay, so the Reeds eventually did make a little bit of money because they started having gold mining on their property. But how do you feel about that jeweler? You feel like something not quite right happened, don't you? The buyer and the seller are not both aware of the value of what's being transferred. There's this huge discrepancy, and the one who's buying is willing to let the seller be completely ignorant of the value of what he's selling.
It's so weird. It's just like, as a jeweler, you should be super honest about what you're...
You should.
At least, like, if you're going to a jeweler, you expect them to be at least honest about it.
You're exactly right. And it is true, jewelers do, they make their living on integrity. If I leave a diamond ring with a jeweler, I want to make sure that what I got back is my diamond and not something, not cubic zirconia or whatever it's called. Indeed. All right. So guys, do you see how this is the flip side of number one? The buyer can be in a position of trying to conceal from the seller the true value of what's being sold. And if you really do think through this, it'll mess up some of your assumptions about business. The world would say, you know what, you're just being a shrewd businessman. You've got a lucky day. The Bible would say you took advantage of your neighbor and your neighbor's ignorance. And that wasn't fair and just business. That was theft. I think the average Christian would not even think about such a thing, and that's why I'm wanting you to be mindful of it. I'll make an acknowledgement here that there is, I would submit, real propriety in a kind of business dealing, a kind of tradesmanship, in which there is a certain amount of knowledge of the value of things that a buyer-seller compensates himself for, and there's no inequity in that. For example, I have a brother-in-law who does a fair amount of thrifting. Actually, this is from my brother-in-law. He found this jacket in a thrift store, and he knows enough about clothing to know when he goes to a thrift store, whoa, that's a really nice suit. And someone just donated it to the thrift store. And all the suits in the thrift store are whatever, 75 cents, $2, $5, whatever. But that suit, it's used, but it would sell for $600, $800, $1,200, whatever. Guys, there is a realm of business in which, for example, the thrift store really does not want to spend the time, invest the energy in getting a bead on what each of its items of clothing is worth and selling it for the market value on eBay. They don't want to do that. And so they just put their items out there on the floor, and it's one of those situations in which there are fines to be had, and if someone has come to educate themselves enough in the realm of clothing, for example, to know a really good suit from a really bad suit, which I don't know, that's a way of being compensated for your knowledge. There is legitimacy in that. You can extend that into the business world, but that is only to a certain point. Listen to this tough statement from one of the commentators on the Eighth Commandment that I've read. The concealment from the vendor of a recent increase in the value of what he sells in order to buy it for less than it's worth is an injustice. You're buying from somebody, you know that the value of what they have has just gone up, and you don't want them to know that. He's saying that's an injustice. Those who plead for this urge that their special knowledge is their private property, which they have a right to use for their own profit. Did you follow that? That's the rationalization for it? The answer is that knowledge affecting a joint transaction, like bargain and sale, where two parties' rights are equitably involved, is not private property and cannot be monopolized without violating the law of love. It is to be feared that the chief practical obstacle to the proper application of this principle is the consciousness that it would cut too deep and condemn the larger part of what nominal Christians practice. Whoa. He said, this is Robert Downey. He's saying there's a lot of theft in business in just this area. All right, we need to move on. Number one and number two. Now number three, ways that doing business can become theft. That's taking advantage of our neighbor's need to buy or sell. Have you heard of price gouging?
What about the medical industry?
Excellent. All right, you've anticipated my opening illustration of this. By the way, my text is Exodus 22:25. It's actually a reference to something called usury. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a money lender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him. And this is a reference to loan sharks. People who have money to loan to the poor, and they know the poor have no real options. They don't have good credit, and so they're not going to go to a regular bank in order to get regular interest rates. And so they'll take out loans, short-term loans at 18, 20, 25% interest. That is what you call a loan shark. You'll see those signs often in certain parts of town. But that's an example of taking advantage of your neighbor in their state of need. They need to buy or they need to sell. Here's one, Zach. Here's one of my illustrations, my notes. You're one of three manufacturers of insulin. Insulin is an absolute necessity for diabetics. The other two manufacturers run out of supplies. Guess what that means? You pretty much can charge whatever you want. That's called an inelastic demand in economics. An inelastic demand means it doesn't matter how expensive insulin is or how cheap insulin is, it's going to be pretty much the same amount of insulin that people will buy. It's inelastic by way of demand. This is, of course, what everybody would recognize is a dreadful practice. And no pharmaceutical company would do this. At least in an overt way. That's seen as price gouging. Remember when we had a couple years ago, I can't remember what it was. Was it the hurricane down in the Gulf? And immediately all the gas prices, or many places, went through the roof. They were charging $2 and $3 a gallon. Not everybody, but a few. And those people, those sellers of gasoline, in many cases here in the Charlotte area, got at least embarrassed. There was some legal action taken because that's called price gouging. It's taking advantage of the need that someone has who is either going to buy or to sell. Those are some pretty obvious examples. What about if you are wanting to buy a house from somebody that you realize is in a desperate gotta sell situation? Gotta sell. You realize, you know what? I'm going to lowball them. Because I happen to know they are desperate. They're going through a divorce. They've had some family calamity. Somebody's something or another. I'm going to lowball them. I'm going to get the price as absolutely low as I can. And if they say yes, I have a clear conscience because it was a straight up deal. They said yes, and this is what I'll offer them. Guys, there's a moral principle here. The moral principle is, I'm stealing my own thunder, it's the golden rule. What would you want done to you if you were in that place? Would you want the fair market value of your house? Or would you be content with somebody lowballing you in your state of need? Mr. Rob.
With that part, I have one thing. So in the state of natural disaster, it's harder to get the good into the location, and people have a tendency to buy all of that good. So would it be okay price gouging in that situation to keep those who would normally buy all of it and hoard it,
so that
there would still be some left, even though it's more expensive to other people? Would it be okay for them to do that so that there is some left to other people?
That's a great question. It shows that there's some complexity here. There is this thing called supply and demand that sets the value of the market's price. So when we talk about the market price, we're not talking about something that's just written somewhere in the sky. We're talking about I'll show my political hand. In a free market system, what are people willing to pay? That's the market value of something. David's pointing out that a crisis takes place down in the Gulf, and all of a sudden plywood is running off out the stores, right? So Home Depot could probably charge five times as much for that plywood. And you could say in some kind of very localized way, you know what, demand just went way up, and so it's only natural for the price to go up. True, when demand goes up, price goes up, but again, the scenario we're talking about is an exceedingly temporary demand, right? And a demand by people who are in a state of great duress. And in the example that you use, we could think about that at some length. It is oh so very temporary, isn't it? Because there's going to be supplies rushing to that part of the country, and the Home Depot in North Carolina is going to help out the Home Depot in Texas, I'd like to think. Yes?
This kind of came to me. It was, I guess it's more to do with the insider trading, but I know there are some claims of people that realized kind of before the pandemic where this was going, and before general public had that knowledge, they invested in distance learning and online Zoom platforms. I mean, that would be good for COVID or something, but the stuff like that is pretty general.
That would have been a great tip. Buy toilet paper, yeah.
But is that also stealing? Because you're not selling. But it's still inside knowledge. And where is that line? You just know it ahead of people.
So that's a great question. In the realm of investing, high profit and conversely being spared the downfalls of the market, very broadly speaking, is the reward of the canny. It's the reward of those who are deeply aware of what's happening in the world and in the economy, and good profits. In the investing world is, very broadly speaking, the reward of someone spending their waking hours trying to be understanding of things. And so it's not insider trading when someone hears about the coronavirus that's starting to spread in China and says, whoa, this is going to be big. And he sells his stock before the plunge of last March. That's just somebody who's being rewarded for their canniness, in my judgment. However, you might know that one of our North Carolina senators came under fire for doing exactly that. And why would that be a problem? Well, because he was in a position of knowing what the average investor wouldn't know. He maybe, I can't remember the details, if he had made some kind of visit to China or if he was involved in some committee that was more intimately aware of this. So the question, I don't think there was any law broken, but the question was he in his position aware of something that the rest of the people owning stocks wouldn't be aware of? And did he take advantage of that? And you know what? It becomes a question of, does this pass the sniff test, in a sense? The eighth commandment isn't something easy to enforce in the business world, to be sure, or in the political world, but that's an insightful question. Let's move on. Number four, when doing business becomes theft, borrowing from our neighbor apart from a reasonable ability to pay. Ladies and gentlemen of a younger age, please listen carefully to what I'm about to say. The scriptures are crystal clear. Pay your debts. Romans 13:7, give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. Pay your debts. The Bible is full of this teaching. Failure to pay a debt is stealing. Your creditor loaned you money with an agreement that you would pay it back with interest. That's how loans work. You take the money without any serious consideration of how you'll pay it back, without any reasonable ability to pay it back, you are a thief. Now, this is where I hope you can see, like the other commandments, remember sixth commandment, you didn't intend to run over that little child. You were just driving at 50 miles an hour through a neighborhood. You didn't intend to run down with a little child. But the sixth commandment requires you to take pains to preserve your neighbor's life. The eighth commandment requires you to take pains to preserve your neighbor's property. And if he's loaned money to you, it's his property. And if you've taken out that loan, apart from any reasonable ability to pay, you're in violation of this eighth commandment, this stewardship principle. Now, here's the problem in the U.S. of A. Your creditor does not have a name or a face in the U.S. of A. You want to borrow money for a car, right? That's way okay. No problem. You borrow money for a car. Do you know the person you owe money to? No. It's some big bank. Likewise, you want to borrow money for a house. Do you know? Is there a person? Is it like Joseph is the guy who loaned you money? And if you don't pay Joseph back, he's up a creek? No, there is no Joseph. There's just this big corporation, right? If you have one of those little plastic things that fit nicely into a wallet, guess what? You're borrowing from Mr. Visa. Who cares about who Visa is? It's just this nameless entity right? And they're huge, and you know, they have gazillions of dollars. And so what's happened in our world, in our culture, which is a debt-run culture, is that people are very ready to take out loans because they don't know a single thing about the people they're borrowing from. And guess what? If they don't have the ability to pay because they didn't actually think about it, they didn't actually do the due diligence to know, can I actually pay this much for a house every month? No big deal. Our culture has made it relatively easy peasy to walk away from debt. Now, it will ruin your debt scores, and you'll have a hard time getting a loan the next time. But you can sanitize that over time and so on. It's relatively easy. In the old days, they would throw you into what? Debtor's prison. And we think that's awful. Yeah, there were all kinds of awful things. But you know what they were actually doing back then? They were holding people who owed debt, who had taken someone else's money and did not pay it back. They were holding them responsible for it. I'm not making a case here for debtor's prison. The Bible actually has a different remedy for that. And I don't have time to go into it, but it's called indentured servitude. That's actually the remedy the Bible has for it. You can't pay your debts, okay? Well, then you'll have to work to pay off your debts. We can come back to that perhaps in a Q&A time. My point here is the eighth commandment requires you to pay your debt even if you don't have a clue who the actual person or people are that you owe it to. I've talked to people who have racked up 60 and 80 and more $1,000 in credit card debt. Guys, it's easier than you think. 60,000, 80,000. If you have multiple cards, you can get beyond that. And they file for bankruptcy. Their credit is shot. And the $60,000 or $80,000 that they owe to American Express or whatever, you know what happens to it? We just think, you know, it's a big company. Who cares? You know what happens to them? These big companies are not stupid. They know people will not pay their debts when they issue credit. Guess who pays for the people who don't pay their debts? You do. You pay for it in those percentage of each purchase that the credit card charges the vendor for being able to use Visa. And it all just gets cycled back to the customer. You should not overlook this. When Cleveland over here defaults on his $80,000 Visa, Kellogg over here has to pick it up along with everybody else. Because Visa is not going to say, oh, Cleveland, you're killing me. All right, here's the money. No, they'll say, yep, certain percentage of Cleveland's in the world. And we're going to make Kellogg pay by our fees. So, you don't pay your debts, you're stealing from society. You may not have the name, may not be Joseph, may not be a nice guy like him, you're stealing from society. I'm giving you this Dutch uncle talk because some of you already have credit cards. Yikes! Eighth commandment requires you to be very conservative and careful when you borrow money. Miss Kellogg.
So, let's say you took a loan with the full intention and the money to pay it back eventually. And something happens to which you no longer have this money.
Yes.
It's something not in your own doing, and you have to declare bankruptcy and all that fun stuff. Is that still considered stealing? Because it is beyond your control, and you had the full intention of paying it back.
Sure. The Bible anticipates this. I touched on this a moment ago. This requires a whole societal structure for this, so it's not as if the individual is in complete control. But the Bible is aware there are times when, particularly in the case of the poor, they go into debt and they don't have the ability to pay. Or, for example, it's a parallel but very different situation. Someone has involved themselves in theft. And remember last time, the remedy for theft, restitution, if it was calculated, professional theft, it may be compounded restitution. It's, you have to return five oxen for the one you stole. Well, what if the guy doesn't have five oxen? Guess what? He doesn't just walk away. Either because of circumstances of life that have impoverished him or because of his own sin. The Bible's remedy, guys, it's actually a form of slavery. Now, this is not slavery like our nation practiced it, perpetuated by the crime of kidnapping, which in the Old Testament has a death penalty attached to it. This is not American slavery, but it's a form of indentured servitude that the Old Testament prescribes for the person who finds himself in a new, he owes his neighbor something, either because he stole and the law says he's got to repay, or because he took out a loan and he doesn't have the ability to. So in such a situation, when you run across this in the Old Testament, be careful that you don't associate it with everything that our country knows about slavery. There are provisions for fulfilling Eighth Commandment obligations that take the form of working for someone else. And when I've been in the situation of counseling someone who's got $80,000 in credit card debt and they don't have the ability to pay it, I say, you may not simply walk away from that debt. You can make an appeal to the credit card company. And there are all kinds of provisions for this. Credit card companies want something. They'll often negotiate. That's perfectly acceptable. You negotiate your hospital bills. You negotiate your credit card. And then you say to them, till the day I die, I will pay as much as I can. I will pay. Eighth commandment requires us to pay our debts and to enter into loans wisely and carefully. Number five. When doing business becomes theft, a failure to work diligently for an employer is a violation of the Eighth Commandment. If you're employed by someone else, your employer has purchased your time and your labor. That's how it works. That's the nature of your trade. You're saying, I've got something to offer you. It's my money, my expertise, my time, and you have something to offer me. It's your money. It's a great deal. Most of us will be in a situation where we are working for someone else. Guess what? If you've contracted to work 8 hours a day, and because of the online game that you're playing, oops, or just your general sorriness, no one in present company, of course, you only give 5 hours of work. Guess who's stealing from whom? Guys, this may be the most common form of theft in our country. I think the foreign worker is such an attractive prospect for many businesses because American workers, I'm speaking very broadly, are often not as hardworking. There's other reasons why companies take their business overseas, and that's because they can pay less, and there's something there as well, aren't there, from an earlier principle. A diligence in labor. Guys, this is one of the most fundamental qualities of a Christian. It's about as fundamental as it gets. To be hardworking. There should be no one that works harder in the workplace than a Christian. I don't mean being a workaholic. I don't mean going well beyond the requirements of the workplace. But guys, think about it. Christians believe that because of this whole thing called stewardship, because of this principle that God has established, that just as He is a creator and a provider and he is someone who has taken the natural world and developed it into something beautiful, so he wants us to do that, we have the highest view of work on the planet. We believe we're no more like, we're never more like God than when we're at work. God is a worker, and we're like him when we work. And the person who is working for an employer, as a Christian, doesn't do a good job merely out of a sense of fear of the consequences of not doing a good job, not working hard. He does it out of a sense of Christian duty. This is what God himself calls for me. His ambition is not greed. It's not fear. It's glory. It's actually glory. Because there's something glorious about vocation, about work. All right, I've spent a good bit of time on number one. When doing business becomes theft, I hope I've tried to flesh out a bit how the Eighth Commandment becomes an everyday issue. And guys, I hope you can see by now, it's not just for those of you who are going to sit in an office or to be a tradesman on the streets of Charlotte or wherever. You got an eBay business? Got a Facebook Marketplace business? You want to sell something on your front yard, little sign? It applies in all of those kinds of ways. I've been referencing number two along the way, and here I want to make it crystal clear. In the Eighth Commandment, we are in yet another way being called upon to love our neighbor as ourselves. Remember, that's how Jesus sums up the whole of the second table of the law? He says in Matthew 22, 39, love your neighbor as yourself. Summary of the whole second table of the law. And he puts it another way in Matthew 7, do to others as you would have them do to you. Now, your neighbor is anyone you meet. That's the definition in the Bible of neighbor. Anyone you meet and have interaction with or opportunity to minister to. And the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Guys, it's not put on the shelf when you enter the realm of business. Doing business. You know the slogans in the business world? Let the buyer beware. In other words, hey, I'm selling. It's your job to figure out if it's good or bad, or what you'll pay for it. Your job to do that. Let the buyer beware. It's the attitude of our culture, and particularly, perhaps, our capitalist society. I'm a free market guy. I'm a capitalist. But this is particularly a sin of the capitalist society. Christian businessmen, I hope there's a room full of you here, are responsible to do business not just with an eye to what profits yourself and your company, your boss. The Christian businessman, if he is a Christian in business, is also doing business with an eye to what benefits his neighbor, his customer, the one he's buying from or selling to. So in business, the Christian is to be promoting the interests of his partners, his customers, and so on, as much as himself. Listen to another author on this subject, Charles Hodge. He writes, the code of morals, you could just say the ethics, held by many business and professional men is very far below the moral laws revealed in the Bible. This is especially true in reference to the Eighth Commandment. Many who've stood well in society and even in the church will be astonished at the last day to find the word thieves written after their names in the great book of judgment. Oh. And folks, I think there is this discrepancy that exists in the church. Fine, upstanding individuals in their church and even in their homes godly men. But they're, what is instinctive and wonderfully reflexive in their ministry in church and home, they get into the business world and they just adopt the whole of our secular culture's dog eat dog ethic. Get what you can. And it's sad to me when I think how much of Christian influence in our society actually comes through business, through this whole world of business. This has all been rather confrontational, I realize. I wonder if any of you are suspicious that I don't have a very high view of business. Wrong. I'm going to take the last few minutes, number three, to tell you that actually, with all of the guidelines that I've been setting forth, derived from the Bible under the heading of the Eighth Commandment, the Christian should have among the highest of all views of making money. That's what business is. It's making money. And of course, money is just a highly liquid form of property. You can have stock, you can have real estate, or you can have cash. It's all property. It's all possessions. Money is the way in which it's the most liquid, as we say. Is making money evil? It's not what the Bible says. Actually, it's one of the ways, one of the primary ways we glorify God. That's what the Bible teaches. How so? Well, I'll just have to be summary in this, but I have four ways in which doing business is good and indeed glorifying to God. Number one, pursuing ownership is good. Remember, the Eighth Commandment presumes that you own things that I don't own and vice versa. That's otherwise there's no such thing as stealing. The Eighth Commandment affirms private property and recognizes that when God entrusts us to have certain things that He Himself has given, He doesn't want us to just stick them in a corner. He wants us to enlarge those things, to pursue gain from those things. That's what stewardship entails. It's cultivating what we have, beautifying it, in order that we can enlarge it, in order that we can share it, indeed, in order that we can give it away. The one who has more is someone who has greater opportunity to be even more of a steward of what God has given. Do you see that? Stewardship. You remember the stewards in Jesus' parables? They're given talents, and what are they supposed to do with it? They're supposed to make them more so that they can be ready on the last day to say, I've been faithful to what you've given. So the pursuit of ownership is good. Ephesians 4:28. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. That's acquiring possessions. That's a good thing and a God-honoring thing. And so is just raw profit, number two. Guys, you know what profit is from a biblical standpoint? Let's say I've invented a widget. To be very original, I'm going to speak of widgets. I've invented a widget. I've spent time and energy of thinking. I've been evaluating a need in the marketplace. I have come up with, through my ingenious mechanical engineering background, I've come up with a widget. And it's involved a fair amount of work. And then bringing it to market is even more work. Guess what? When I sell the widget, when I sell a vacuum insulated drink cup or whatever, the price that I expect you to pay for this is exceedingly beyond the actual cost to manufacture it. Right? Yeah. The difference is called profit. And that profit represents you in the marketplace saying, I value the work, the thought, the preparation, all that that you put into devising this product. It's more than just the sum of the stainless steel. I value your contribution. Do you see something really glorious about that? That's a wonderful thing. When you sell a painting, one of you has put together a canvas and paint, and someone looks at it and says, look, I think canvas is going for a lot cheaper than what you're asking. And I can get paint all day long. I think you got about 2 ounces of paint on that. I can get paint all day long for a lot less than what you're asking. And you say, you are a Fruit Loop. I am selling my artistic ability here. What I contributed to this canvas and paint. You're in the wrong store, sir. You need to go down to the paint store. This is actually a glorious thing that we acknowledge the gifts of other people and pay for that. That's a biblical view of profit. And it's something glorifying to God. By the way, Luke 19 is an example of one of those steward parables that Jesus gives. The third thing I want to say about the goodness of business is that the employer-employee relationship is a good thing. It's God ordained. We've talked about authority structures. I already talked about how there's an economic realm of authority. That's our boss. And this goes directly against Marxist ideology. I'm sure you're aware. Karl Marx sees it as evil, inherently evil, if one person profits from another person's labors. That's inherently exploitative in Marxism. And guess what? The Bible's full of that. It's full of the master-servant relationship. It calls on masters to be gracious and kind to their servants. And it calls servants to labor well for their masters. And you know what, guys? One of the reasons that that's good, and by the way, you all need to know that it's good because you're probably going to have a boss someday. You already do, I know. You're already in the workplace. That relationship of you and the boss, it is all kind of ways that sin corrupts it, but the relationship is a good one. Servant to master. You know why I can tell you it's good? Because God uses that relationship in this life as an illustration of his relationship with us. It's not the only relationship that he illustrates from. He'll use marriage, for example, to talk about his relationship with us. That's pretty sweet. But he also speaks of us as servants of the master. And how you respond in your relationship as a servant is a little way of conveying to others what is our relationship to Christ. And if you become the master in the workplace, you have an opportunity to be a model of what Christ is like as a good master to his people. And the last thing I'll say about the goodness of business is that buying and selling, commerce, as we call it, is good according to the Bible. Proverbs 11, verse 26. The people curse him who holds back grain, but a blessing is on the head of him who sells. The wise man is there talking about the fact that there is this wonderful interconnectedness and interdependence in a society. We can't all grow grain. Some of us need to grow the grain, and other of us need to buy it from those people who grow grain. And that's a kind of interconnectedness and interdependence that's actually a beautiful thing. Well, in a society that does business well, we can have all different kinds of diversity As opposed to the guy who's on the frontier back in the early American history, and he, with his wife and kids, have to do everything. They have to be experts in everything, which means that they're not really experts in a very sophisticated way in anything. In a well-developed business, you have got diversity of vocations or callings or work, and you have this interdependence among God's image bearers. And that's glorious. I am in a lot of work that most people would not call the business world. I just pastor people who are in the business world. And I'll just share with you, I love looking over their shoulders. Because I think for all the sins it can damage so badly, God's image bearers in the business world. Business in itself and what it can attain to is glorious. It's one of the primary ways that God is glorified in the earth. When people come together to use their differing gifts and create things that would be impossible to create separately or individually, and they benefit one another through it all. That's actually one of the most glorious things that happens on the planet. So, business ethics is important because business is glorious. But there are so many ways that Satan has corrupted it. And so God gives us the eighth commandment in order to protect something that he loves. Very good. That will suffice on that subject as I come back next week with you. We're going to talk about the environment. Look forward to being with you.